Welcome to On the Line with the AMA, the official podcast of the American Motorcyclist Association. I'm Alexandra Terhorst. Our guests today are motor journalist, author, and AMA Motorcycle Hall of Famer David Huff and Andy Goldfein, founder of Aerostitch Riderwear, Ride to Work Day, and the recipient of the 2013 AMA Dud Perkins Lifetime Achievement Award. David and Andy have a decidedly practical approach to motorcycling, but like all motorcyclists, their passion for riding runs deep. How did they first get started? Here's David, followed by Andy.
I got started in motorcycling in a way that I'm sure would cause Andy to smile a bit. I lived on Bainbridge Island, and I worked at the Boeing Company in Seattle, and there's 8.5 miles of water in between. So there's a huge big ferry runs back and forth between the little town of Winslow and downtown Seattle. So to get on that ferry with a car for the 6:20 boat, you'd have to be there about 5:20 in the morning in line. So I had tried carpools, a number of things, and a friend of mine bought a little Honda 90 to commute for probably 60 miles a day on a Honda 90. I looked at that and decided that, by golly, motorcycling looked fairly practical for the commute on the ferry. You could ride past all the cars down to the head of the line, board first, get off first, get through traffic easier. So I got into motorcycling for a very practical sense, that it was a good commuting vehicle for me, given the ferry system. And I commuted for, 30 years?
That's a good long commute. Commuting was central to my reason for starting my business also. Commuting is why my business Aerostitch exists. There was a confluence of threads in my life that came together kind of all at the right time around 1982 or 83. The first thing was that my work life and career and development, I was 30 years old or 29, and things weren't coming together the way I had hoped they might when I was a younger person. I was struggling with my father, and my father and uncle had a family business, and there were cousins and brothers and sisters in this business, and I didn't seem to fit in it very well, and I was just not happy with my life. And the next piece was that I wanted to stay in the town I grew up in, which is Duluth, Minnesota. I didn't want to go anywhere. And the next piece was, at that time, industrial sewing was leaving America very rapidly for Asia. Garment factories were closing, textile mills were closing. The equipment to make fabric and buttons and sew things together in America was worthless. You could go to an auction of a bankrupt garment business, and you could buy an industrial sewing machine, which maybe was 5 years or 10 years earlier worth $3,000 or $4,000, for $50. And the auctions and liquidations were being bought by people from China and others from outside of the United States. They were moving this whole industry offshore. About 1 million people were affected. So I got 16 sewing machines for next to nothing. I rented a space for $400 a month on the second floor of an old loft type building. I didn't know what I was going to make. I changed my occupation so that I could have part of my days to work. And I started working at a motel as a desk clerk on the 3 to 11 shift. And that meant that I had the days free to figure out what I was going to make with my old sewing machines. I wanted to make something that I cooked up. These particular sewing machines had been used in a factory that had made snowmobile suits and winter jackets, heavy things. Industrial sewing equipment is very specialized. If you want to make t-shirts, you need a certain kind of sewing machine. If you want to make jeans, you need another kind of sewing machine. If you want to make winter jackets or snowmobile suits, you need another kind of sewing machine. So I had winter jacket, snowmobile suit machines. I looked at things I could make with them that I was familiar with personally. I was a downhill skier. I knew I couldn't make a better ski jacket. There was tons of companies doing that. I was a fisherman. I knew I couldn't make a better fly fishing vest. There was several companies making really good ones. Same with flotation devices, life jackets. And I looked at motorcycling because I was a weekend trail bike rider with my friends, very casual. I had done about 1.5 years of AMA Enduros. And I really liked riding. And to me, what seemed like the most logical thing to do was throw what people call a Hail Mary pass in a football game. In other words, I didn't try to make a better Enduro jacket because those were already out there. I thought if I made something like a coverall similar to a snowmobile suit, but with armor, with abrasion resistance, that's something you could get in and out of quickly, Then I could suddenly ride to my motel desk clerking job without changing in and out of a polyester uniform twice a day. I thought it would be fast, easy, safe, comfortable. And I was hoping that maybe there were other people who did not want to use a Chevy or a Toyota for commuting, like you, David, who used the bike to beat the ferry. I was hoping there would be enough people out there who wanted a coverall for commuting to use a bike instead of a car. The recipe for an Aerostitch one-piece coverall suit did not exist. And I had to figure out what that recipe looked like. What kind of fabrics, what kind of foam, reflectives, where to put the pockets. And so I created that and sent samples of them out to the cycle magazine editors in Southern, most of them were in Southern California. I sent probably 6-8 of them out there, and that began Aerostitch. It was all about commuting, just like you.
What year did you actually start manufacturing Aerostitch garments?
Well, on our labels, it says 1983. We probably started actually selling them in 84 or early 85.
The reason I ask is because up until that time frame, I wore leathers for serious riding and then whatever fabric was available, you know, like surplus police jackets or stuff like that. But when I got back from Europe, then I started looking for other gear. And of course, by then you had pretty much established the market. So from then on, from about, I don't know when my first Aerostitch Darien jacket was purchased from you, but probably about, you know, 85 or something like that.
Right.
And from then on to the end of my riding career, I wore basically a Darien outfit.
That's what was funny is I was hoping to make an impact on commuters. And in my fantasies, I was thinking, well, gosh, people would all over the country start riding motorcycles because now they had an easy way to do it safely and comfortably. And I would be the next Henry Ford. Of course, that didn't happen. People really do like their Chevys and Toyotas and their comforts. And the people who were buying the coveralls were not using them for commuting. And it was like many people invent things, you have blinders on. You don't see other than what your narrow vision is. And so the people who were buying the coveralls were using them to go to rallies, to ride to Alaska, to ride for fun. And about 3 or 4 years after making these coveralls, I realized that I had to make what you ended up with, which is a two-piece touring suit, sort of a modern version of a bell staff or a barber wax cotton English jacket. So what you bought was what I thought would sustain the business, would make us solvent, something that a rider could use as a recreational for touring or dual sport riding or whatever.
Well, of course, the problem is that you made them too durable.
Yes.
So I think I went through something like 3 Darien outfits over the years, but that's not enough to make you rich.
No, it hasn't made me rich. I have had, in hindsight, the most wonderful life and not gotten rich. The people I work with, I'm not an expert on business school ideas and stuff, but if you have a job that you really don't like the people you're working with, you're supposed to try and get another job if you can. And I don't socialize with the people I work with, but I like them and they seem to like me. And I think that makes work go 1,000,000,000 times easier if you can stand the people that you're coming in to do something with. And if you sort of can identify a little bit with the mission, whatever it is, whether you're working on a food processing plant or making Aerostitch suits, I really think I lucked out. And my hindsight is you're not supposed to compare yourself to other people, but I know people who made other kinds of choices when they were young and that were easier or had more money. They've struggled more than I have. Not every day it's easy to go to work, but most of them are. And right now I'm not retired like you, but I really get to call my schedule. The people who make Aerostitch suits are the best in the world. I'm very proud to be working with them and to be associated. They make me look good, frankly. I'm not a business guy as much as a storyteller and a design guy. So I've got some great people.
How do we learn to ride? And how do we become lifelong learners? Knowledge and experience are crucial. And then there are those things you do every time you ride that aren't so scientific.
One of the things that I stumbled into very early in my motorcycling career, and this would be back in the late 60s, was that I thought I knew something after a few years of riding. And then I realized, no, you're just in the basement. There's a whole other level up there. And so I stepped up into the next level. You know, and then I thought, well, I, I'm up in the second level now. I know quite a bit about motorcycling. And then a few more years go by, and then I realize, no, wait a minute. Wait. There's a whole other level up there beyond that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I assume the same thing is probably true of you in the garment business.
It is. And it's motorcycling is one of those activities that's especially cool in my view, because it cuts across age, it cuts across gender, it cuts across economic station in life. You can be black, white, red, green, poor, rich, tall, short, whatever. And if you're on a motorcycle, you're 9 times out of 10, you're grinning. It just works at a very primal, fundamental level, the kinesthesia or whatever. And like you say, it's an onion. You keep peeling more and more layers the longer and longer you do it. And I can remember the moment I rode a pedal bicycle for the first time without training wheels. Nowadays, kids have these little balance bikes with no pedals, and they start them as toddlers, and they paddle around the driveway, and they learn to balance with no training wheels. But when I was a kid, those kind of little bikes didn't exist. And so I started with a little bicycle with training wheels. And I remember the day that I don't remember if it was my mother or my father who took the training wheels off, but it was my mother who took me to the top of a small hill near our house with her hand on the saddle balancing and let me go. And I remember that moment today with detail.
Interesting. We didn't have training wheels in my day. You know, you had a bicycle, and you either rode it or fell off. You know, and I can remember my father doing exactly what you're talking about, holding the saddle, pushing me down the street, and I'm saying, it's going to fall over, it's going to fall over. I said, no, just pedal, but it's going to fall over. And then it didn't fall over.
Yeah, it's magic.
And I thought, whoa.
You go out to your garage, and your bike is on the center stand or the side stand, and it's sitting there, and you might have a beer in your hand, and you can sit there like Peter Egan in a folding chair and look at your motorcycle and go, this thing is magic. And that's what attracted me to riding. And it's still magic. And I think it'll be magic until I can't physically do it anymore. Your books had a tremendous influence on me and thousands of other riders on how to consume motorcycling as an activity with the minimum amount of deadly risk. It was really a life well done, I think.
Well, of course, that was why I got inducted into the Hall of Fame, was because of my writing. And I didn't really encourage it, but I thought, you know, it's time that we got people that we looked to in motorcycling other than racers. You know, that I have nothing against people who race, and yet there are other people out there who also do things, and also people in motorcycling like yourself, who have done things that are very important to day-to-day motorcycling, commuters and travelers and things, who don't always get the recognition that they deserve. So I was glad when I got inducted to see that somebody other than a racer.
Right. I agree with you. I think racing's fun and important. As I said, I did enduros for several years, and the racing is probably the fastest teacher of how to ride well that there is. I mean, it's the most intense. You're so focused when you're on a track or at a track school or an enduro or at a motocross. You just are totally in the moment, and boy, do you learn quick about how to ride a bike physically well. So there's a value there for me, I think, and for any rider who wants to better their skills, just like there is to taking any kind of education for riding. Didn't you help develop the Oregon template for the MSF program?
Well, I've had my hand behind the scenes in a lot of things. The Experienced Rider course that the MSF developed was built around something that I had been doing in the Seattle area. I've always been kind of amazed that, for instance, when I first started riding in 1965, I looked around for information on motorcycling tactics, and there really wasn't anything. There really was nothing. Just like you and the gear for a commuter, there wasn't anything. I started looking for information, and I gathered information. So anybody that wrote anything about it, and there were people who had written something about motorcycling way back when that was available. I went back through old copies of Road Rider magazine and found things, and I ended up being a member of the Boeing Employees Motorcycle Club. Boeing Company had a recreation department, And one of the clubs that they sponsored was a motorcycle club. And so they offered a meeting space and a stipend per year, $200 or something. I started offering tips at the club. And then I decided to try sending some off to Road Rider. And they liked that concept of having a regular writer for the skills topic. And so that's how I got into that business. And then ultimately, my columns turned into books. But what I've always kind of wondered about is the average rider out there, the motorcyclist who got into it for whatever reasons, and his interest in staying alive and how he thinks he is going to do that. And I guess the best illustration of my curiosity about that was when I did a seminar many years ago now, but it doesn't seem like that long. And it was on conspicuity, the idea of being seen.
Yeah.
The epitome of which, of course, would be the high-vis Darien yellow-green jacket, you know. But the idea being that we have this myth that other drivers bump into us because they can't see us.
Right.
And so if we're brighter and whatnot, maybe they won't. And of course, the interesting truth is that in something over 90% of crashes, the motorcycle is the striking vehicle. So it isn't necessarily the other guy banging into us, although if he gets in our way, we'll accuse him of causing the crash. But still, who is responsible at the moment is whoever's holding on to the grips,
right,
ultimately. And so I did the seminar, and it was all about conspicuity, and I dealt with issues like inattentional blindness, or people psychologically, their brain doesn't want to see you because it doesn't care about you, and all these issues. So at the conclusion of 90 minutes of discussing all these details, just in fine detail, I had a question and answer, and final question was, you know, the hand goes up, and the guy says, "Mr. Huff," he said, "would riding with his headlight on high beam all the time help?" And I thought, this guy sat in the front row, and he listened to all this, and he somehow thinks that if we just had the magic switch. I went home and realized what this guy wanted, and I assume many other motorcyclists want, is a magic talisman. You know, and of course, I sent you this product for your evaluation, and you turned it down. But the magic talisman is a medallion that you wear around your neck that guarantees absolute safety at all times. And it's guaranteed so that for only $14,999, you can buy one of these, put it around your neck, and you'll be safe. And if anybody dies wearing one of these, we'll cheerfully refund the money to anybody who shows up with a receipt.
Traveling is, even before the motorcycles existed, traveling has always been hazardous. We sell steel horseshoe off an actual used horse.
That's a platform.
It's got a countershaft sprocket welded into the center of the horseshoe, mm-hmm, to hang on the wall of your garage or your door to your backyard or wherever you go out to get to your bike. And people have been hanging horseshoes on barns since there's been horseshoes to sort of bless the journey. That once they leave their home and get on a horse or go for a walk, you know, there's St. Christopher medals, there's those little bells that are hung from the frame of the bike below the engine. We're not ruled by superstition, but we're made to be believers. We're hardwired for this. And it just is what it is. This is who we are. We want good outcomes, and you can do all the right things and still get run over by a bus. It changes the odds statistically quite a bit if you wear high vis and if you wear a helmet and if you double check your mirrors and do this and that. But at the end of the day, we need to feel that we can do it, that we need to feel confident enough to get on that thing and balance and go down the road. And believing in the little bell hanging from your frame or the horseshoe above your garage door or whatever helps us tackle that. I don't know if you do this, and I don't know if other riders do this, but when I go for an all-day ride and I get home and pull into the garage or just go into the driveway and turn the bike off for the last time, and after that day of riding, and pull my helmet off, I sort of turn and look over my shoulder at the bike and say a silent thank you every single time. I always go, thank you. That was great. Like the bike that somehow protected me.
Well, see, you should have patted your motorcycle safety medal on your throat, you know.
I think we're made to have some sort of a purpose in life. I think we're made to manage risk. I think we're made to be believers. And I don't know why we're made this way, but it's important to believe you can do something, to handle something, to try. And motorcycling is that, yeah, a try for me.
I have to agree with you that if we look at the positives and the minuses of motorcycling, we look at the good stuff and the bad stuff, A lot of the good stuff is that when you're riding a motorcycle, you get creative ideas and you get lessons in life. And I've started putting together some writings that haven't been published before about lessons from the road, about situations that I've been in where I had things that I learned that were interesting, not just about motorcycling, but about life. And that was the positive side. The net result, of course, is at the end of the ride, where I'm beyond the end of the ride now. I don't ride anymore, but I don't have to forget all those good things.
David and Andy have seen a lot in their many decades of riding. As they look back, what stands out in the world of motorcycling?
A number of years ago, when Harry Hurt was still alive, I had gone for a visit down to his place, and I asked him about the type of crashes that were occurring, and he said, well, the same sort of crashes were occurring with motorcycles at that time as had occurred 20, 30 years before, except on more expensive motorcycles at higher speeds. That's a big issue, is simply that we and other people around us continue to make the same mistakes, but we have jacked up the odds because we're now on machines that are capable of doing 0 to 100 in 5 seconds, that sort of thing. You put the human body on an open vehicle with no means really of protection. I mean, and I'm not trying to downplay your gear, but we misunderstand how injuries occur and make decisions based on that. But I think that even though we have lots of protective gear these days, we're still seeing the same sort of crashes, the same sort of injuries, and we're now able to measure this in terms of having better data. One of the first big studies was the report we call the Hurt Report, which was paid for by NHTSA, and that came out in 1981. And so a lot of things that people know, if you will, they think they know about motorcycling comes from that time frame.
Right.
Well, if we tried to figure out how to fly jet airplanes based on what we knew in 1981, we would really be behind the curve. So times have changed, and motorcycling has pretty much stayed with the same old myths that people are still saying, what? There was a study on motorcycles?
One of the things that I think changed for me was that there was a fulcrum or pivot point when the museum exhibit at the Guggenheim called The Art of the Motorcycle came up. The way I interpreted that, it was a wonderful exhibit. It was the most popular art exhibit that the Guggenheim Museum had ever produced. And it ran for a year or two. Then it went to Chicago. And it was a huge deal. And this was a bunch of intellectuals who basically said, they're not tools, they're art. And I grew up thinking of them as tools. For competition or transportation or whatever. So I read the book that accompanied the exhibit. I went and saw the exhibit, and suddenly they were art. I didn't know how to handle that. So we printed little round stickers that said, not art, to stick on your book.
I have a little story that relates to that, which is that I was invited to go cover BMW's K1 introduction in Roma. Let's see, at that time, I forget whether it was Road Rider or Motorcycle Consumer News, but so they flipped me over there, and here I look at this beautiful piece of artwork, 1,000cc motor and all that, but basically, you're looking at this plasticized vehicle. This thing has been tested in a wind tunnel for aerodynamics. When I went back home to write the report on this, the review of this machine, the question was, well, so what's it good for? At the time, I thought, one thing that machine would be good for would be a side hack puller, a really swoopy sidecar puller, because you wouldn't need to carry the load on it, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't dare tell that to the BMW engineers and the marketing people, that your swoopy machine is only good as a sidecar puller. But years later, I walked into a BMW shop, and right there was a used BMW K1, bright silk blue color, and I bought it, and I ultimately ended up building a sidecar puller out of it. So was it art? Well, what I said at the time is that if you spent the roughly $15,000 for one of those things and just lifted up in the air and bolted it up onto the mantle as a piece of artwork, It would be spectacular because you never drove it. But you're right. Motorcycles do have in them a sense of art. And I've used some of my most pleasurable times as sitting out in the garage in the wintertime, which I had insulated and heated. So I could sit there and listen to the heaters tinking and look at my bikes and think of something to build and go oil something or adjust something, and just the smell and the odor of the motorcycle thing.
Most motorcyclists don't talk about when they will stop riding forever, but true to form, David and Andy have a few thoughts on the subject.
You know, I say to people, so what do you think the end of your motorcycling career is going to look like? And the answer that I often get is, well, I want to keep riding forever until I just can't do it anymore. But hardly anybody wants to talk about what that means.
Have you ever seen that 2 or 3 minute or 4 minute long commercial that was made for a bank in Taiwan of these 5 or 6
yes.
old guys
yeah,
who decided to ride around Taiwan, and they're all in their 80s and they had a group of riders when they were teenagers? It's just the most moving thing.
Well, see, you're talking about old people in their 80s as if that were really old. and here I am at age 84, and I don't think of myself as being really old. But yeah, I appreciated that because on the one hand, we're talking there about people who are, by God, going to live the dream. They're going to pull themselves out of the rest home and get on a motorcycle and go somewhere. But the actual reality of it is that life presents you physically with some insults.
Yes.
You know, various body parts don't work. Or as one saying goes, at my age, everything hurts. And if it doesn't hurt, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So there comes a time when your body refuses to cooperate with the motorcycling anymore.
Right.
You know, probably the first part of that for me was, if I can't stand up in a tent to get my pants on in the morning, I can't camp. You know what I mean? Later on, I discovered that the body was going to refuse to sleep on the ground anyway, but you know, there's certain parameters. And so you go to hop on your bike one day, whatever your bike is, and you swing your right leg up over the saddle, except that, bam, you hit the luggage rack, you know, and you go, ow, 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 ow. Okay, well, the first time that happens, that's probably a good message. But if it happens 3 times in a row, that's probably a strong indication that this is kind of the end of your riding career, unless you figure out a different way to do it. So
I think that's the key.
Yeah.
So to know your limits, and the limits are both physical and mental. I can't predict my own future, but you know, if I have trouble, I'm going to end up on something like a Honda Grom at the very end, riding on surface streets only.
When I decided to retire from motorcycling at age 80, I decided that I'd been there, done that enough. And the insults from my body were beginning to add up and that sort of thing. So I ended up taking my huge pile of gear. You know what I mean? Here's a whole closet full of 3 or 4 sets of Darians and electric vest and, you know, gloves and helmets. And, you know, and I called the president of the Washington BMW club. And I said, look, I'd like to donate some stuff to the club. He said, that's great. He says, I'll ride up there and see what you got. I said, no, don't ride up. Drive your pickup truck, your van, your dump truck up. You know what I mean? And so he brought a pickup truck, and we filled that thing full of gear, which they subsequently auctioned off at the next year's rally. And I happened to know people, good friends of mine, who are still wearing my gear out there in the real world. So my gear is motorcycling long after I've dropped off the bike.
Although Andy and David see one another only occasionally, they have fond memories of the times their motopaths have crossed.
Do you remember the last time when we've only been together in real life twice or 3 times maybe?
I believe the last time we were together was down in the Fremont area of Seattle when you had a pop-up, you know, measuring show down there. Yep. And I was just thinking about that, realizing that I don't think I took you up to see the trolls under the bridge.
I know those trolls. Those are cool. I remember each time we were together very, very well.
And of course, in between, I've attended at least one of your non-rallies.
The very boring rally. The older I get, the more boring they get. sounding.
Well, I don't know. I've always thought of that as being you.
Well, it is what it is.
You're one of my heroes at motorcycling. So there you are.
Our thanks to David Huff and Andy Goldfein for sharing some of their hard-earned wit and wisdom from their collective years of riding. On the Line with the AMA is a production of the American Motorcyclist Association. Since 1924, the AMA has been promoting the motorcycle lifestyle and protecting the future of motorcycling. Learn more at AmericanMotorcyclist.com.